You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
Hello, world, and welcome to Tales from Hollywood Land, a veritable feast of movies, television, Broadway, showbiz stories, news and gossip, with Julian Schlossberg, Arthur E. Friedman, and Stephen J. Rubin. Today, we are talking silent films, Lee Scientis. And now, here's Julian, Arthur, and Steve.
Hi, this is Steve. I always seem to start out the conversation because I kind of like going first. Since I used to be picked for games in elementary school, I was always picked last. So here we are. Lee, welcome to the show. I actually have a question to start off the festivities. You always hear about the jazz singer being the first talkie. I mean, obviously 1927 was a big year for the talkie movies. And yet you never hear what the first silent movie was. And I'm just wondering in your research, whether you can go all the way back and tell us, like, who was the first to roll camera? I kind of feel like I've heard this as Thomas Edison. Is that true?
Even before Thomas Edison, there were the Lumiere brothers in France. It's amazing. During the mid-1890s, there seemed to be a kind of confluence of everybody working on film at the same time. I don't know exactly who developed celluloid, but apparently it was decided that Edison in 1894 decided that 35 millimeters should be the width of a cellulose nitrate a base to on which to record images. So it's really hard to say. And I've learned, I'm not a historian, I'm just an enthusiast, but it's very difficult to say anything happened first. Because if you do, then someone will come up and say, uh-oh, no, there's something before that that happened before that.
Well, we can talk about the first that we kind of know in America that's the most popular. It was probably the Great Train Robbery in 1903 that Edison actually was behind. And a first Western star, Bronco Billy Anderson.
Correct.
But, Lee, as far as you're concerned, I've heard about something called the Dawson Find. What is the Dawson Find?
I'm not fully, but this happened in Alaska. Apparently, people were doing in Dawson, Alaska, they were doing an excavation to just build some edifice. And they came across this boarded up pit that was full of decaying, deteriorating nitrate silent films, some copies of which were unique and which dated to way, way back to the earliest days of the 20th century. And they turned out to be Dawson City was apparently the final stop on a circuit that the films went on. And so instead of returning the films to their owners, they just buried them. They threw them away. And so this, and flash forward, you know, X number of decades later, and the films are uncovered in Dawson City to the delight of film historians everywhere. And the filmmaker Bill Morrison has made a film comprising of excerpts from these films, including the decay that you see on the edges of the films. But some of the films were actually in okay shape and okay enough to be able to be seen. So that's the Dawson City find.
Wasn't there a big story recently from maybe Nebraska, somewhere in the Midwest, where somebody found a very important silent film with Clara Bow?
That is correct. They found a short film in both 35 and 16 millimeter, but it was fragmentary. and they are going to be debuting the latest restoration of the short film. Apparently, she's 17 years old, and she's only in it for a brief time, but it's going to be premiered next month at the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, which I'm attending. So, yes, people will get to see a very rare Clara Bow film from the very beginning of her career.
Lee, what is some of your history that brings you to be a lover of silent films?
I don't know if any of you remember the Black Hawk Films catalog. Does that ring a bell with anybody?
Yeah, Iowa.
Davenport, Iowa.
Right.
From the time I was a toddler, I loved the notion of film images being projected on a screen. So from the time I was 6, 7, 8 years old, my parents bought me 8mm cartoons that lasted 6, 7 minutes to play on our home projector, along with our home movies, which I was fascinated with. So flash forward to being 12, 13, 14, I see where I get a hold of a Black Hawk Films catalog. I don't know where, but they specialized in selling films in 8mm and later Super 8 for the home market. This was prior to home video, of course. So they had a $1.99 200-foot sampler that I bought, and on it was a clip from a film called Intolerance. Including a clip from the Babylonian sequence of the film, and it just absolutely blew me away. And I said, you can buy Intolerance? So it was a 3-hour-long D.W. Griffith film, and I took my $79 of allowance money, and I sent it cash to Davenport, Iowa, so I could get this film in 8mm. My mother refused to write a check because she said, I don't want you spending that much money on a film. So I sent the cash, and a few weeks later, they honored the order, and I got the film, and I watched it twice, 3 hours long, the day I got it, and I was hooked.
Well, it's an incredible movie. It's 4 stories in one. That's we know right. Lillian Gish and many others are in it, but the most interesting thing for me was that the title cards were written by Anita Loos.
That is correct. She worked for D.W. Griffith.
Yeah, and she wrote, of course, Gentlemen Prefer
Blondes. Right.
The sad thing about that movie, as brilliant as it is, and it still is a brilliant movie, is the fact that it was a flop. It died. He did not do well, and he put his own money into it. Isn't that right?
He did. He had made a lot of money from The Birth of a Nation. But what he did was he told 4 stories over differing periods of history that illustrated the theme of intolerance. You could say almost every film has that theme. But what he did was he created 4 stories from 4 different periods of history, a modern story, circa 1915, when the film was made, period in French history, the St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, a story of Christ, and a Babylonian sequence, which dealt with the fall of Babylon. But instead of telling each story and then finishing the story and then starting the next story, he intercut the 4 stories. And therein lies perhaps why the film was a big flop. Because the reason was supposedly that people were not able to follow the intercutting of the 4 stories among one another. And what he did, he would cut the scenes shorter and shorter and shorter. Each story had its own climax in which someone's life had to be saved. And we obviously know what happened in the case of Jesus Christ. But each of the other stories, and he cut faster and faster and faster. Pauline Kael called it the greatest film ever made because of its dealing with historical subjects, and it was one of the first spectacles ever done. So,
and it was said that he did it partially in response to The Birth of a Nation, where he had the Klan kind of glorified and the African-Americans kind of made pretty bad guys. So I think this was his so-called apology. Is that true, Lee?
It was his answer to his critics. Know that D.W. Griffith was working from the perspective of a Southerner who grew up listening to Civil War stories. Mm. So when he created The Birth of a Nation, which despite is both a great film and a horrible film, it's a racist masterpiece, he came from that perspective. And he became very defensive over what he perceived as unjust attacks on him. So Intolerance was kind of his answer to his critics, but it did not connect with the public.
Did it ever, Lee, to be clear, did it ever find success?
Only through film history and film historians, even though nowadays D.W. Griffith is not really a name that people talk about. Mm-hmm. Film historians 70 and under still know who he is, but the newest generation, he's a forgotten figure.
Yeah.
And although Intolerance was dubbed in 1968 by Pauline Kael as the greatest film ever made, this, she said in the New Yorker, in response to its annual showing at the Museum of Modern Art, you'll find virtually no one who will agree with her.
Well, the one thing I was lucky enough to do was to watch Way Down East, a film he made in 1920. And at that screening was Lillian Gish, who was in the film.
Wow.
And she said that she decided, not he, to put her hand in the water and her hair in the water.
Huh.
And from that frozen water, which was shot in Vermont in the wintertime, where they're jumping from ice floe to ice floe, her hand never healed again. It was frostbitten and never got together. It was a pleasure to meet her. What a lady she was. And that film, that audience, we went crazy for that movie. And interestingly enough, it was a film that made money. That was one of his, besides...
That was his biggest moneymaker.
Even bigger than Birth of a Nation?
Next to Birth of a Nation.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
They really could. That was 1920. Birth of a Nation came out in 1915 when it was hard to kind of track. There was a thing called states' rights, and people bought the film outright and pocketed all the profits. So it's really kind of difficult to know exactly how much money The Birth of a Nation made, but they estimate on the basis of people that went to see it, that it more people saw it than any other Griffith film. Next to that, the one by 1920, when Griffith was making new movies for United Artists, they were able to have more of a handle on money. And that was his, next to Birth of a Nation, probably biggest, highest grossing film.
Do you know what Birth of a Nation cost?
I do not know, but it was in these low six figures. This is when movies did not cost very much.
Well, we should also talk in terms of, Lee, the incredible amount of great film directors who came out of the silent period.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's a staggering thing. And we can start with one of our favorites in Alfred Hitchcock and The Lodger. That was really quite... I think Hitchcock called it his favorite of all the silent movies he made. Is that right?
It is, and it was the movie that literally put him on the map. It's literally the movie that started the Hitchcock legend and the Hitchcock trope. He had been making movies for a couple of years, but this was the film about a potential Jack the Ripper. That was his first really, really big success, correct?
And the first time he gave himself a cameo, and he gave himself two in that movie.
That's right. That's right.
Here's an interesting quote from this book, Hollywood, The Oral History. Great, great looking book. My wife found it in the library. God bless her. King Vidor, who was a very significant player in silent films, says briefly, "So this was the magic of silent film, stars and stories and stunts. And I don't know whether someone else talked about what happened when sound arrived, but I know that most of my friends and other directors were just horrified with the idea of being able to use words, not musical accompaniment, Not sound effects, but words. It was just a terrible idea, and I'm sure that anyone at the time felt that we were being ruined by words, and it was true for a while. But why? It was just like saying to Marcel Marceau, "We've had enough of your pantomime. You've got to start speaking tomorrow." You could imagine the feeling of Marcel Marceau if they told him that, and that's the way we felt about sound.
That's true.
Hard to imagine.
Hard to imagine. And in fact, in preparing for this talk with you gentlemen, I literally found out that people thought that maybe the talkies were a phase, that eventually they would flop and people would go back to the silent film that they were used to.
It's true. And one of my favorite quotes of all in show business is Harry Warner, one of the Warner Brothers, who said, "Who the hell wants to hear actors talk?"
And here's a one-liner from Charlie Chaplin, who said, "Just when we were getting it right, it was over regarding silent films."
Oh. That's right. That's right. Literally, if you watch films from 1927, 1928, the best of them, they seem to have a kind of perfection, because they knew exactly how to photograph people, what people thought, not only what they said through intertitles, but how they felt. And you had great actors who knew how to convey with their face what was the intent of the film. It was a remarkable achievement. And then just when they seemed to have mastered it, in comes the talkies.
In comes Jolson. You talked about that when you were a kid. When you were a kid, where what city were you in?
I'm a Southern boy. I grew up in Columbia, South Carolina, the same city as Stanley Donen.
Yeah. Wow.
But he escaped from the South. I stayed.
I just came back from Columbia, South Carolina. I signed my books there.
You're kidding. Did you go to Barnes & Noble?
No, I went to a local bookshop, and I'm going to forget the name of it, but I have a book called The Cat Who Lived with Anne Frank. It's a children's book, and the Anne Frank Center is on the campus of the University of South Carolina. So they hosted me, and then I went to do some signings, and I also met with middle schoolers and elementary schools, but I was in your hometown, Columbia, South Carolina.
That's great. And I think that's terrific.
Hey guys, a question. Yes. Is Columbia, South Carolina, by any chance, the town that Nancy Mace comes from? Just kidding. Just kidding.
Well, let's get back to our subject, which yes. is the cat. What important to talk about, it seems to me, is that when you mentioned Chaplin, he comes out years later, in 31, 4 years later, and still has the temerity and the guts to put out City Lights, and it's a silent film. Incredible
right.
that he did right. that.
It was
he was fighting
gamble.
Everything.
How did it do, Julian?
It did well.
It did well, huh?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, he was very important and at that time. I mean, my God, we all know the films he made, and years later, Lee, probably 36 or so, he makes Modern Times, which is almost a silent film, right?
Almost a silent film. The only full-fledged sound film that he did didn't come out until 1940 with The Great Dictator.
Yeah, it's right. It's truly true. But that was an incredible group of great comic people that we kind of still watch, between Chaplin, the incredible Buster Keaton, and the
Harold Lloyd.
Harold Lloyd, Harry Langdon, Laurel and Hardy, Mack Sennett and the Bathing Beauties. I mean, Charlie Chase. There were so many. It was
yes.
an incredible learning period. And that was a great quote, author, about the fact yeah. that they finally learned it and they had to give it up.
Julian, and years later in the 70s, I believe it was the 70s, Mel Brooks decides to do a silent movie.
Right.
And the only reason he got it made was because of Young Frankenstein and,
Blazing Saddles.
Blazing Saddles.
That's right.
And it succeeded, by the way.
And how about The Artist? The Artist comes out, a silent movie, and wins the Academy Award.
What did you guys, Lee, what did you think of The Artist?
I liked it, and what I liked most about it was the fact that it drew attention to the silent period. It kind of reclaimed it for a new generation that may not have been aware of it.
Yeah, we had a theater in Fort Lauderdale at the time, an art theater. We played it very sold out. It was a big, big hit. But I sat with the audience, and they loved this movie, as I did. It was beautiful to watch. And
that begs the question, how difficult is it to get new generations interested in silent films? I mean, you know, the 1950s is ancient history to these people. That you go back to the teens, what are some of the challenges that we face today, Lee, in terms of getting people excited about silence?
It's huge, and I think it's more of an individual thing, like it was with me. That being said, I go twice a year to the San Francisco Silent Film Festival, which, you know, has wonderful crowds. Over a week period, they show like 20 different programs. And then in October, I travel to the Pordenone Silent Film Festival in Italy, takes place again over a week and shows the most remarkable restorations that are current that from the archives around the world. And it draws people from everywhere, from four corners of the globe. It's amazing. So there's still an interest there. But I agree with you, Steve, that it's a challenge to get people in the era of TikTok and instant media to literally have the patience to watch people do the unnatural thing of emoting without using their voices.
I mean, one of the other problems that's unbelievable is that they don't want to see a black and white talkie movie.
Exactly.
They don't want to see a black and white film. And we all know from King Kong, It Happened One Night, it goes on and on. Some of the greatest movies are made at Grapes of Wrath in black and white. So
listen, people don't know who Humphrey Bogart is, much less Lillian Gish.
Well, especially in the U.S., young people are not interested in history, and it extends to film history. Now, I have to confess that I am not a knowledgeable person about silence, but I'm a big science fiction fan, and I finally sat down last year, and I watched Metropolis.
Whoa.
And I was blown away by the production values of this film.
It's an incredible film.
And I'm forgetting the name of the filmmaker.
Fritz Lang,
and who, of course, had a big career in talkies as well. Obviously, this was Germany pre-World War II.
Yes.
If the listeners have never seen Metropolis, it's a haunting movie on many levels. I particularly like the musical score that accompanied it. And I wonder if that was the score they played in the theater when it ran in the theaters. I guess that's the way it was done in those days. They would play music live while they were doing the theater run, correct?
That's a great point, Steve. The biggest films, the biggest budget films, the studios in the large cities, particularly New York and LA, would often commission a score to be played by a live symphony orchestra opposite the film. And in the case of Metropolis, what's so wonderful about it is that not only was there a score composed specifically for the film, but the film was edited to the score that was created for it. They're literally in the cue sheet of the score itself. It says where there's a close-up, and the conductor has to coordinate the orchestra with what's going on in the screen. So it's a great, great, great score.
So they were scoring the film in the theater live.
No, it was scored before. But then later on in small towns, when you didn't have a symphony orchestra, you had maybe a pianist or a small ensemble improvising to what you see on the screen. It was only with the big films that they had cue sheets. And they did scores that were specially composed for the film.
But the scores were recorded. I would imagine.
No, they were not until
they were actually playing with every performance.
They play with every performance, correct?
Oh my God! Yeah.
So
yeah,
when sound came in, a lot of people were out of work. A lot of musicians.
Yes, and we should point out there was something known as the Mighty Wurlitzer.
That's right.
Incredible organ that would play, but also in some cases, believe it or not, had sound effects.
That's right.
Wasn't just music. They would have, let's say, the horses galloping, kind of like radio, the sound effects that they used in radio. They'd have horses galloping, people punching, people yelling. It was quite something. It was really an incredible time to have been an exhibitor or a distributor or a producer of movies.
It was a time of ballyhoo and showmanship that I think, they created. For the silent era, there were picture palaces that were literally, you know, made up like Oriental minarets, and literally they created this environment, this atmosphere of grandeur that people that grew up during that period that knew that never forgot it. I mean, we're talking about palaces where literally, and especially in New York City, like places like the Roxy, you'd seat like 3,000, 4,000 people at a time.
Yes.
It was incredible. Back to what Steve talked about in Metropolis, this was a movie that was so expensive, that's shot for almost a year, that almost broke the German film industry. They had spent so much money on that movie. And on top of it, it is, I think, some of the greatest science fiction effects to this day is in that film.
It is. Steve, the creation of the robot, transforming the robot Maria to the real Maria, isn't that a great laboratory sequence?
Oh, no, that is a great thing. And it's funny because I have a friend in L.A. who for many years owned Robbie the robot from the movie Forbidden Planet. And he had a big Metropolis robot, replica in the room, and I never quite knew what that was. And so finally seeing Metropolis, I was able. Now I have a question about a movie that, or an actor who my mother was always telling me special things about, and who was probably one of the most famous romantic figures of the silent era, which would be Rudolph Valentino. What made Rudolph Valentino such a Taylor Swift of his day?
Patent leather hair.
He was the first of a kind of Latin lover that literally spoke to the passions of the women of the 1920s. He had a smoldering quality to him, and only rarely did he have the opportunity to give a real performance because he was considered so, you know, sexually volatile to women of the time. But he was a good actor. And the other thing that added to his mystique is that he died young.
He
died when he was in his 30s. Yes.
What was his nationality?
I don't know.
I think he was Brooklyn born.
What did he sound like? Anybody hear him speak?
He had an accent, but I don't exactly know where he came from. I'm sorry. No.
But I will tell you of one of my favorite stories of Valentino. He makes a movie called The Son of the Sheik. And here are the credits. He takes Agnes Ayres, this actress, and he kidnaps her and takes her to a tent in the desert. And she says that the card comes up and says, "Why have you brought me here?" And Rudy's answer is, "Are you not woman enough to know?"
Women went crazy.
That begs the question about the sexuality of the period. We know later, with all of the codes, you know, the Hays Code and the Breen Office and all of the censorship during the silent era. Was there serious censorship, or were the filmmakers rather chaste when it came to presenting sexuality?
Well, they counted on the personalities of the performers. They never got, there was seemed to be a kind of explicitness, but there was never a code that guided what went on the screen until sound came in. And the particularly the Warner Brothers in particular was interested in the kind of more transgressive aspects of human existence. But I wouldn't say that there was much of that in the silent period.
But there was pre-code, and there was some a lot of stuff that was
pre-code,
women not wearing bras.
Pre-code
and
authors all that. Really kind of they kind of label that from 1929 to 1934.
So talkies,
they literally code it to the talkies and not the silent period.
I do want to say that as a kid growing up in the Bronx, like Julian, but I never forget, we went to a friend's house. I was about 10 years old, and he showed us in the top drawer of his father's bureau, there were these little silent porno films.
Yep.
And guys, they were porno, and they were silent. But for 10-year-old kids, we didn't know what the hell to do with ourselves. What is this? What's happening here? You know, but they were silent. They were silent. Didn't have
pornography. Pornography knows no bounds.
No bounds.
No medium. Nothing is off limits when it comes to human beings' impulse.
Lee, there's a thought in the motion picture business that in truth, the biggest grossing film of all time was not Gone with the Wind. Was not Godfather, what have you. It was Deep Throat,
right,
which was being sold to theaters for 25%. But you have to pay on Thursday in cash. That was the whole crazy deal.
Won there a little bit of a kind of not entirely legitimate concern collecting the money?
Well, they paid. That was part of the deal. You have to pay on Thursday. Somebody's going to show up named Irving. He's going to show up and you'll give him the money, and that will be that.
Or don't Guido. Not give him
well, right.
Yeah.
Or Guido.
Well, I want to tell you guys a story that I'm fascinated by. I may have mentioned it once before. I'm watching The Hunchback of Notre Dame. Lon Chaney, who, of course, was the man of a thousand faces, the son of two deaf parents. And that's one of the reasons he became the man of a thousand faces. He was often putting different faces on for his parents and acting out as a child. But I watched The Hunchback of Notre Dame, and there is a scene where he is the hunchback is being flogged. He's got his arms in a thing, and they're hitting him, and the camera cuts to men and women watching and kissing. So a little S&M in The Hunchback of Notre
right.
Dame.
And you know what Red Button said about The Hunchback of Notre Dame as to what he said to his tailor? He said, forget the slacks, work on the blazer. That's what he said. Lee, when have you sustained yourself? Is silent films an avocation to you through your life, or is it your business?
It was my gateway drug to movies in general.
Gotcha.
And I've become obsessed with movies, and I moved to Atlanta in 1979 to work for Films Incorporated, which was a non-theatrical 16-millimeter distributor that distributed films of the studios to colleges, universities, libraries, churches, anybody that would advertise in a newspaper. And I worked for the Atlanta branch of Films Incorporated. We had 6,000 films in 16-millimeter that we could watch at any time, in addition to renting them.
I remember.
That's where I saw all the films that literally gave me my background in film history. Mm. And then later, but the last job I had was working for Turner Broadcasting as a rights analyst when I did rights research for Turner Classic Movies.
So you've always been working for your passion. That's great.
I've been very fortunate. Yes. I never made a lot of money, but I was happy.
Well, what you got is more important than money, of course.
As we all found out. Tell us a little bit about the RKO story and how you were able to do what a lot of people couldn't do before you.
Well, one of my jobs at Turner was in the legal department, as I said, a rights analyst. So what I did, I had as my work tools were all the legal documents of all the films that Ted Turner bought in 1986, which meant the RKO films, all the RKO library, all the pre-1949 Warner Brothers films, and all the pre-1986 MGM films. We had all the studio contracts and all the underlying property agreements of all those films. Ted bought those when he bought the library. So one day, someone from TCM said, there's an RKO film that we've never shown on TCM. A viewer has asked about it. It was called Double Harness. And they said, why? Can you find out what's what? So I went to the paperwork and I found out that Double Harness was a 1933 film that had never been part of the library, the RKO library that Ted Turner bought in 1986. It had been sold out of the library along with three other properties back in 1947 to Marion, producer Marion C. Cooper, who was the producer of King Kong, but who over 18 months in 1933-1934 had run RKO. He was head of production. So he never felt that he was paid adequately for his head of production role. So in 1947, they came to an agreement, the settlement. That RKO said, okay, we'll let you take the rights. We'll give you $16,000, and you'll take the rights to like four properties that you want. He wanted the Lost Patrol. The John Ford film was one of the films he wanted, but they wouldn't let him have that. So they gave him the rights to four films, including two films that were remade after the time he was production head. And those films literally were owned by his estate for years, were shown briefly on New York TV in 1956, but then went on ice and had never, ever been shown before. And we found out that these films were owned by someone who was a business associate of Marion C. Cooper's. We found the son of that business associate, and TCM made a deal to buy all right, title, and interest to those six films.
That was incredible because no one knew where those films were. You were able to kind of dig and finally find where they were. It was quite a job, and it was written up by a lot of people, too, people who love movies.
It was the proudest thing that I've ever been involved with, and they're little films. None of them are great, except maybe for the 1938 film A Man to Remember, which was on the New York Times 10 Best of the Year list, but literally was one of these films that had not been seen in literally 50 or 60 years. It happened to be the directorial debut of Garson Kanin, and it was a script written by someone named Dalton Trumbo.
Oh, a lot of pedigree. Wow. A lot of pedigree. Well, I want to talk about the fact that in silent movies, which of course were not silent because there was always a movies track, so it was kind of wrong, but it was silent as far as dialogue is concerned.
Correct.
There was always someone who wrote the story, but that person rarely wrote the titles in the movie. That was a totally different person, a different art. In fact, it reminds me of when you're on a newspaper and you're a feature writer and you write a story, you don't write the headline. There's a headline writer on a newspaper. But that's interesting that happened in silent film, Lee. Was there ever any examples of people doing both?
Well, that's a good question. You brought up Anita Loos, who literally did not write the script for Intolerance, but she wrote intertitles. She wrote dialogue titles for it. And in the case of Intolerance, there was never a script, which is amazing. Mm-hmm. During the early period, they literally kind of made it up as they went along. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until the 20s, and then in particular with Fox Film Corporation, they had two people that were title writers. They had not worked on the scenario to the film, but literally they were brought in to provide the dialogue titles for the film. And they got credits, but as titles by Catherine Hilliker and H.H. Caldwell, that never got a credit for writing the script. Yes, that happened.
Yes.
How did they find it? How did they greenlight a movie without a script?
Well, they wrote a scenario. They called it a scenario.
The pitch, yeah.
And that's how they, so there were things. I've never seen what a silent film script looks like, but obviously it's going to be quite different from what we see from scenarios and scripts written for the sound period.
What I was interested in was the fact that at the beginning, there was no name of the actor or actress in the movies. It was the girl, it was the guy, it was the villain. And finally, the girl with the golden curls, known as Mary Pickford, got her name as, and she became this gigantic star.
So big that
she was able to get a percentage of the profits of her movie, which of course had the rest of the boys in the business turning over.
Julian, can you imagine how much business these things were doing in 1915? Charlie Chaplin, Mary Pickford getting $10,000 a week, which today would be equivalent to, I don't know, $300,000, $400,000 a week or something like that.
It was incredible, Arthur, and it's true. Lee, what else happened with this star system at that point? Were the moguls fighting it as best they could?
No, actually, it was one other way to market the film. And it's so funny, back when D.W. Griffith started directing movies, and he would direct little one-reel films, which were the things that were mostly in vogue during the first decade of the 20th century. And he directed about 400 one-reel, that's 8 to 12-minute films, with a stock company that worked for the film company. And one of the people in that stock company was Mary Pickford, who was not known as Mary Pickford back then. She wasn't known as anything because they did not literally tell anybody what the names of the stars were. But because the films became more and more popular, people wanted to know, who are these people who are starring in the films? And finally, Biograph, the company that Griffith worked for, had to put out a full-page ad in the trades mentioning the names of the people that were in their films. And therefore, there began the notion of people. And Mary Pickford became literally, because of her appearance in the Biograph films, and a woman named Florence Lawrence, who never had much of a career beyond Biograph.
But what a name.
Florence Lawrence, yep. Yeah. They were stars. They were stars. And people, it's a natural, literal development of the movies as a popular form. Not only were you interested in the plot and the film, but you were interested in the people. And let's face it, that makes sense.
Well, they weren't only people. Wasn't one of the biggest stars in silence Rin Tin Tin?
That's right. Absolutely. In fact, that was Rin Tin Tin was the star that made Warner Brothers before the jazz singer. Rin Tin Tin was making movies in 1923, 24, 25, and saved the studio.
It's amazing how that can happen. Little Shirley Temple kind of saved Fox. I think Francis the Talking Mule and Abbott and Costello saved Universal. I mean, it was really quite a history.
You know, the great quote that Julian and Lee and Steve and Mike, great quote by John Huston, was drunk with Robert Mitchum early in Mitchum's career. And Mitchum was really acting very cocky and conceited. And Huston said to him, "Always remember something, Bob, that you're a movie star now. Just remember that Rin Tin Tin was a movie star, too."
That's right.
And that dog was a movie star.
Mike, I'm interested, Mike, in your take on silent film. Do you ever watch them? Do you like them? Do they mean anything to your generation, so to speak?
Well, to my generation, I am not 100% sure. But to myself, I grew up on silent films. My grandfather raised me on Buster Keaton, Charlie Chaplin, Metropolis, Nosferatu, you know, some of the amazing stuff that, you know, I got to see growing up. But then, you know, when college, I studied animation and the history of animation. And, you know, starting with Gertie the Dinosaur, which is the first animated film back in, you know, it was a short by Winsor McKay, I think. And it was just amazing. But you had Little Nemo, and then, you know, you also had Betty Boop, and you had all these different characters. And then, of course, beginning with Disney with Mickey Mouse and such. So it's pretty, you know, amazing stuff that you had in the silent era. And, you know, like you guys have mentioned throughout, it's, you know, it's history. It's some of the most amazing work you've ever seen. Heck, I'll put the silent version of Napoleon out there beyond the Ridley Scott one that just came out earlier this last year.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, it's an amazing movie. It is truly an amazing film.
Mm. Yeah. My wife, Barbara, is a film fan and loves to watch TCM silent movies. Loves them.
Silent Sunday nights. It's a tradition. And so it's funny, Mike, you mentioned silent comedy. That is the gateway drug for many people for silent film as a medium. Chaplin and Keaton. For me, Buster Keaton. I bought The General and I bought Steamboat Bill Jr. when I was a teenager, around the time that I was buying Intolerance. And I would invite friends from high school over to watch it, thinking maybe they might like it like I do. And they went nuts. They would go crazy over Buster Keaton. The women in particular fell in love with Buster Keaton.
Keystone Cops, which was just amazing. And, you know, when I went to New York City the first time, I was looking for the Keystone Cops, you know, and I was a little kid, but, you know. But it's just awesome.
I also think there were some great biblical spectacles, you know, early Cecil B. DeMille, The Ten Commandments,
King of Kings,
King of Kings, Ben Hur. I don't know if Cecil B. DeMille.
That wasn't Cecil B. DeMille. That was a director named Fred Niblo. Yeah. But DeMille literally inherited the mantle of D.W. Griffith, who started the biblical spectacle thing with Intolerance, the Babylonian sequence in 1915.
And as you say, Ten Commandments.
Right, 23.
And King of Kings, and there was Sign of the Cross also that he did. I'm 14 years old. I'm working on the newspaper in my high school, and I'm sent down to watch and meet Cecil B. DeMille. He's now making the Ten Commandments in the 1950s. And I went up to him and talked to him, and he was as cold as any man I ever met.
To a 14-year-old kid. You're kidding.
Yeah, but he did sign my program. They gave us a program. All the high school kids had gone, and they gave us a program, and he signed it. And I've spent hours trying to find the damn thing.
Oh, wow.
Anyhow,
so, Lee, do you have a favorite silent film? That is, I mean, you mentioned a few, but is there one that you really have a special place in your heart for?
There's a movie that King Vidor directed in 1928 called The Crowd.
Oh, yes.
That he made for MGM. And it's literally one of the greatest films ever made, not just silent film, but film. And it's about a young couple literally trying to make a go of it amidst the anonymity of the great city, New York City. And it is human, it is full heartfelt, and it is literally one of the greatest films ever made. But it's difficult to see because there are not, that's another problem with the silent era, is the survival rate. It's estimated that almost 80% of all silent films are lost.
Mm.
Well, because what kind of marketability would they have after sound came in? The studios didn't want, and one studio in particular, Universal, junked all of its negatives and material that did not have a soundtrack on it in the early 1930s, an entire studio.
And also the nitrate often burnt up
Actually, it burned up. It was remarkably, it was not resilient at all and aged very poorly.
But did you have them, Lee? Did you have them at Films Inc. in 16mm?
We had some silent films in 16mm, correct.
No.
And we had The Crowd. We had a movie called City Girl, which was directed by F.W. Murnau, who directed the film Sunrise, that many people think is the greatest silent film ever made, which is another great film. I believe, Steve, you mentioned that film in a previous episode before.
I think we mentioned it, Steve, when we were trying to figure out about Academy Award winners, and none of us had seen it.
Yes.
How do we see The Crowd today if we want to, Lee?
It's very difficult. It's not available on any home video except old VHS and Laserdisc. It's not come out because now the quest for home video is to try to get something out in the best quality possible, which is to say high def, 2K or 4K resolution. And unfortunately, that costs money and people do not perceive the silent film era as something that generates income for corporate owners. Hmm. So The Crowd is really kind of missing in action.
Lee, did they ever make a silent color movie?
Yes, they did. But it was two color Technicolor. And not only that, before two color, which was red and blue on the same negative, they would tint films, which is to say they would put the film in a bath and tint it blue for night scenes, red for daytime or orange for daytime, amber for daytime, or red for battle scenes. And it added, so rarely were films not shown with some sort of color, hue, or tint to them. That's a good point.
Yeah, and also we should say that DeMille's original Ten Commandments, which ran about 2.5 hours,
right,
had almost 50 minutes in color, to Technicolor, as you said, almost 50 minutes in color with Moses and the stone tablet, and it's incredible that it was colorized. Also, I think it was it Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde that was sepia? I'm wondering, there was one film with Barrymore. I think it was that.
It might have been. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
As Edward G. Robinson said years later, where's your Moses now?
Where's your Moses?
Anyway. You know, I want to mention something. We were talking about Rudolph Valentino earlier. There was a Yiddish theater actor in New York. Julian, you might know his name. Lee, maybe. You guys, I forget his name, but he was the Rudolph Valentino of Yiddish theater. And I forget his name. I will come to me somehow.
It wasn't Menashe Skolnick, was it?
No.
Was it Joseph Schildkraut?
No. Cheapest, I wish I could find the name, but he had one of those great names. But he would satisfy the neighborhood. This guy was running around in between shows. He was stripping everything in sight. And word would get around, and he was Rudolph Valentino to this Yiddish audience. Wow. In New York City, downtown, of course. I don't know his name anymore.
Before we finish, can we talk a little bit about the actors from the silent era that did not transition into sound? Because I know it was spoofed in, of course, Singing in the Rain, but there were really serious problems for some of these actors whose voices, I get the impression, were a little too high-pitched.
That's exactly true. And the most probably prominent of the so-called casualties was John Gilbert, who was the great lover of Greta Garbo in the 1920s. But he had a voice that, because of the sound recording material of the time, recorded high, therefore not romantic. So he is considered, but when you watch his films now, they don't seem quite, when you listen to his voice, it's not quite so bad, but there were stars that did not transition well, particularly women, especially people like the Alina Lamont type, that had a very severe urban accent that did not translate well. I cannot tell you any names right off the bat, but it was a thing. It was definitely a thing that voices did not translate to sound, and their careers were essentially ended.
Well, sure.
There are so many films that we didn't get a chance to speak of that were just incredible. We never spoke of Eric von Stroheim and his ability to make incredible movies, but he was kind of a bit of a dictator.
He was an autocrat. He was an autocrat and wanted movies made only his way and at lengths that were not economically feasible. Who wants to watch a theater, sit in a theater for 6 hours to watch something called Greed?
Yes.
Greed. I have to tell you that in the book, Hollywood and Oral History, there's a Billy Wilder comments on Eric von Stroheim. Would you like to hear it?
Please.
Of course.
Okay. Billy Wilder on von Stroheim. I always liked his pictures and I liked him. As a very young kid in Berlin, I collected his autographs. Once that he had sent back, one that he had sent back to for my requests, I decided to do that picture, Five Graves in Cairo, and we cast him as Rommel. He's not an actor, really, but a tremendous personality. He arrived from Paris, where he lived while we were out at Indio shooting tank scenes in the desert. Great movie, by the way. When I came back to the studio, they told me that Stroheim was in Western costumes, trying on his uniforms as Rommel. I had never met him before in my life, so Western Costumes is just around the corner from Paramount, you know, on Melrose, and I rushed across the street, and there he is. So I clicked my heels and said, "My name is Wilder." He says, how are you? In order to be kind to him and make him feel good, I said, who would you ever thought that little Wilder is going to direct Big Stroheim? Would you have ever thought that? And he just sort of nodded to me a little bit. I said, "You know, your problem, Eric, is that you were always 10 years ahead of your time." And he looks directly at me and says, 20. That was it. That was Stroheim. And then Greed. Of course, that was the beginning of when Hollywood started to be afraid of directors who are let loose. Somebody told me that Stroheim was shooting Greed in San Francisco, and he stopped shooting for 3 days because there wasn't enough horse shit in the streets. They had to collect it from all over, from San Jose or wherever, all over, because that's what he wanted. Plenty of good horse shit.
Well, it's a good thing.
That's a great anecdote, especially you always just hear about I was 20 years ahead of a time.
Yes.
But the rest of that story is just so great, Arthur. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, and I'm so glad they had not invented smell-o-vision at that time.
Was that Mike Todd, Steve?
I'm not sure, but
I think it was.
It was a very short-lived craze, but et cetera.
It was Mike Todd, Mr. Showman, yes.
Well, I'll tell you very quickly, the problem with smell-o-vision was that after the film played, you couldn't get it out of the theater.
Right.
The smell remained.
Lee, do you like contemporary films? Are there some sound movies of late that you've particularly liked? I know we've been talking a lot about silence. What's your opinion of modern filmmaking?
I it's really funny. I don't see very many movies that are in the theaters, or I really don't go to the theaters because I have a home theater in my house. I have a 100-inch screen, and I've got all the streaming channels and TCM. So why do I need to go to the theaters, which is a very bad thing on my part? We need to patronize the theaters. We need to go to movies, and we need to experience them with audiences.
The studios have to meet you halfway, though. They've got to stop producing 9,000 Marvel superhero movies
and start
giving a little bit more, a little bit more dramatic buck, a little more comedic buck. All the genres we grew up with have somewhat disappeared, and now we just get, for the most part, I kind of call it into, you know, all the sci-fi spectacles and then 20 depressing movies at the end of the year.
Steve, read Peter Bart today.
They need to stop making movies for 16-year-old boys.
Mm-hmm. Right. I will read Peter Bart today. I'm sure Peter had some rather pithy comments on this.
Lee, thanks to Julian, you were a great guest.
It's been my pleasure to speak with you, gentlemen. Yeah. I listen to you every week.
That's great.
I look forward to it.
We enjoyed it.
And if you've been listening today, please join subscribe to us. We love the subscriptions. It's free. How many things are free in life? We are on all the platforms. We also have a YouTube channel. And if you have, as I say every week, if you'd like to write to us, you can write to us at talesfromhollywoodland@gmail.com. We love suggestions for topics, for guests. Please reach out to us. And thank you for being a part of our Tales from Hollywoodland world.
And if I get the name of that Yiddish theater, Rudolph Valentino, I'll email it to you guys.
Yes, you better.
Women who saw him always said one thing. You got a minute? That's what they said.
We know it wasn't Gene Bayless.
No.
Pardon the interruption. We'll bring you back to your podcast in just a moment. But first, promo for the Cosmic Pizza Podcast.
In the Cosmic Pizza Podcast, your pizza delivery guys, Dan, Sean, and Paul, serve you a slice of life.
As we discuss literally anything in the universe.
Conspiracy theories?
Movies that we've liked. Women in comedy, voice actors, film directors and producers, authors.
But what we don't talk about is pizzas.
Wednesday, I'm here with you people. It's wild.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping at the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.